This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The case of the Wilmington 10 is among the most infamous trials in North Carolina history. 10 civil rights activists were wrongly convicted of charges stemming from violence in a school desegregation protest. The district attorney fabricated a story, and the judge collaborated in the effort to stage a sham trial that resulted in convictions and prison in 1972. The case gained international attention. In 1978, Governor Jim Hunt shortened the prison sentences. The convictions were overturned in 1980, but it would take another 32 years before the Wilmington 10 were actually pardoned. Kenneth Jenkin is a professor of African, African American, and Diaspora Studies at UNC Chapel Hill. He told the story in a new book, The Wilmington 10, Violence, Injustice, and the Rise of Black Politics in the 1970s. He reads from that book January 21st at Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh, but first joins me on the program. Kenneth Jenkin, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Tell us, give us the historical context, the protest, and what led up to the protest and then ultimately the trial.
Okay, well, the Wilmington 10 started from a case in 1971. And let me just, we talk about the Wilmington 10 a lot, but they're actual people. So let me just tell you, the Wilmington 10 were Ben Chavis, Reginald Epps, Jerry Jacobs, James McCoy, Wayne Moore, Marvin Patrick, Ann Shepard, Connie Tindall, Willie Earl Vereen, and Joe Wright. They were nine young African-American men in their teens or early 20s, and a white woman, Ann Shepard, who was in her 30s. They were involved in a fight over school desegregation in Wilmington in 1971, and for their participation in that, the state of North Carolina and also the United States government brought the full force of the law and the legal system down on them.
So and we should talk a little bit about this. 1968, the schools are ordered to be desegregated all over North Carolina, right? So this is 1968. And how that desegregation order was carried out was at the root of some of the protests by 1971. Tell us about that.
Yes, that's right. The black high school in Wilmington, Williston High School, which was a community treasure, was shut down. It was turned into a middle school, and the students there were sent to previously all-white high schools in Wilmington. While they were there over the next several years, they faced problems with the principals. The teachers, generally speaking, ignored them. There were fights in the hallways. The principal would discipline black students and let white students go. When police were called onto campus, they took the names of black students and let white students go. There was also a number of instances of, I think you could only call them adult white thugs coming onto campus to rough up black students. And after 3 years, there was steadily building anger and dissatisfaction with the situation, and black students at the high schools called for a boycott in the first week of February of 1971 to protest these conditions. They found a church in Wilmington to be the boycott headquarters, and they walked out. News of the walkout spread through local media.
If I can stop you for just a second, sure. It's quite a successful boycott, too. Most of the students walked out, upwards of close to 80%, right?
That's correct.
Very successful.
It was very high, and you know that number would include both people who stayed home as well as a couple of hundred people who were actively involved in planning and carrying out other activities.
So they organize, and that is significant in itself. We should just pause for a moment and spotlight that high school students organized, and what they organized was a nonviolent protest, a boycott. We're not going to participate in this. Out they go, and these high school students succeed largely in what they wanted to do, not in the ultimate goal, but in the imminent goal of getting people to walk out of school.
Well, that's right, and they did succeed, and they succeeded against a certain amount of indifference or, let's be charitable and say indifference on the part of adults in Wilmington who perhaps were cowed by the memories of 1898 or who were fearful of losing their jobs or whatever. But the organizations, the existing civil rights organizations in Wilmington were not taking up the cause, and the students had to invent their own organization and received help from the United Church of Christ's Commission for Racial Justice.
So we'll talk about 1898 that you referenced in a minute, but talk about the help they did get from UCC.
Mm-hmm. They met at the only church to open its doors to the student boycotters was the Gregory Congregational Church, which was a United Church of Christ congregation. And the minister there had contact with many of the boycott leaders through his work in different anti-poverty organizations or after-school programs, and he let them come in and use the church. He fairly soon realized that he did not have the resources to help them, and he called on his denomination for help, and the United Church of Christ Commission for Racial Justice, which was, I guess you would say, the social justice arm of the church, sent Ben Chavis, who at that point was in his early 20s, sent him to Wilmington to help organize the students.
What happened next? And what was the response of the school board to all of this?
Well, the school board, let me step back a second here. The students had developed a list of demands, things like, we want the police off campus. We want to get these white thugs off campus. We want to be able to be cheerleaders or athletes on the teams. The black students had been excluded from all types of extracurricular activities. They wanted help with tutoring, things like this. They wanted the Martin Luther King holiday to be recognized, and they wanted to have a black studies curriculum. And they took these grievances to the school board, and the school board refused to consider it. And the school board said, "We won't consider this until you go back to school. If you don't go back to school, you will be suspended or expelled." So the school board was really unresponsive.
Right. So now we've got the UCC. Ben Chavis comes in, is sent by the UCC into North Carolina to help organize. Mm-hmm. What happens next?
Over this first week of February, a local organization called the Rights of White People, which was a breakaway from the Klan in North Carolina, found out about the boycott, and they began sending in caravans to terrorize the church where the boycott was being headquartered and to terrorize the surrounding neighborhood. They would shoot at the church. They would easily pass through police lines. And the boycotters called for police protection. They called for a curfew. The mayor and the police chief refused. And over the course of the week, violence escalated. In response to this violence, students and their supporters organized self-defense. Some people who were not known committed acts of arson and other property damage against white-owned businesses, although I will say here that at least one white-owned business, the owner firebombed his own business in order to collect the insurance money.
We have proof of that.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, that was buried in some FBI documents that I had uncovered. And then there is suspicion that this was the case with other businesses as well. One of the businesses that was burned was Mike's Grocery, which was a mom-and-pop store a block or so away from the church where the students were meeting. And during the time that Mike's was burning, the police shot and killed a student protest leader. And then the next day, a white supremacist drove through police lines, got out of his car and prepared to shoot at the church. And somebody, we don't know who, shot and killed him. When that happened, The police chief and the mayor decided to get involved. They put on a curfew. They convinced the governor to send in the National Guard. The National Guard raided the church. The National Guard imposed martial law and occupied Wilmington for some days. And a kind of unsettled or sullen calm settled over Wilmington because of the force, the superior force of the National Guard. But none of the students' demands were met.
There was violence. There is not a lot of material evidence, as we'll see later, that links any individuals to the particular violence.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, rules of jurisprudence are kind of sticky about this. We'd like to actually link the evidence to the individual.
Sure.
They don't have that yet, but there's a kind of pressure to bring somebody to trial. Talk about how the trial came about.
That's right. Well, in March of 1972, so this would have been a year after the events in the boycott, local officials still were smarting from this uprising, and they wanted somebody to pay for it. And they arrested 17 people on charges related to the violence in Wilmington. All of them were protesters or associated with the protests. None of them were from the rights of white people. And they put 10 of those on trial for burning Mike's grocery store and for shooting at firefighters and police officers who responded to that fire. The district attorney, a man named Jay Stroud, found somebody who was marginally involved in the protests to lie about what he saw.
That was Alan Hall, right?
Alan Hall, yes.
He's your principal witness. Took them a while, and there's a lot of inconsistencies in his testimony throughout, right?
That's right.
And it took the prosecution a while to get that worked out because there's some pretty good evidence that there was a lot of coaching that had to go on before.
That's right. He was in Alan Hall when the prosecutor found him. He was in jail on an unrelated crime. He then confessed that he was the one who set fire to Mike's grocery. The prosecutor worked with an agent from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms to develop a story, which Alan Hall really could not stick to, and he kept amending and embellishing his story. But finally, the prosecutor felt that he had massaged it into shape and then started the trial.
Talking to Kenneth Jankin, who is the author of The Wilmington 10, Violence, Injustice, and the Rise of Black Politics in the 1970s. So again, our system of justice requires at least, if you don't have material evidence, you have a witness. Here's a witness who has been pretty unreliable so far in his testimony. The trial goes forward, and now in jury selection, we can see the complicity of the judge in this case.
That's right. And there are actually two trials, one in June of 1972. The jury selection was proceeding in such a way that given the remaining jurors in the pool, there would have almost certainly have been a majority black jury. At that point, the prosecutor faked a sickness, and he said, I can't continue, and got a mistrial declared. And he then started preparing for a second trial in which he paid more attention to getting a jury favorable to him. He illegally excluded jurors based on their race. He tried to pack the jury with jurors, with potential jurors who said that they were prejudiced against the Wilmington 10, many of whom expressed white supremacist point of views. Many of them, the prosecutor knew, were in the Klan or Klan sympathizers. And the judge went along with this. When the defense attorneys would challenge a juror for cause, saying, this person is obviously prejudiced, or this person has expressed membership in the Klan or something like that, the judge denied those requests. So the judge was an integral part of this kangaroo court.
They're convicted in 1972 anyway. There are appeals and now international protests because the evidence of prosecutorial and judicial misconduct is so obvious and egregious. And yet it takes a while to go through the courts, and the Supreme Court ultimately refuses to hear it. But by 1980, well, I'm getting ahead of myself because I want to get to 1978. The protests are rising. The embarrassment for the state of North Carolina is growing, and Jim Hunt is governor in 78. Tell us what happens then.
Jim Hunt came into office supported by both blacks and whites, and he had a progressive reputation, a reputation as a forward thinker, somebody who wanted to develop North Carolina economically and socially. And he comes into office when the campaign to free the Wilmington 10 is in full swing. He inherits it. I think he wanted to get it. He wanted to resolve it as quickly as he could, but he had a problem, and that problem was that he could not free the Wilmington 10. He could not pardon the Wilmington 10 without alienating his white voting base, and he took an expedient way out and said that instead of commuting their sentences or pardoning them, he would just shorten their sentences. He thought that that they were serving a little bit too long. It satisfied no one.
By 1980, a federal appeals court overturns the conviction. They are already out of prison by now, most of them, right?
Yes, yes.
By 1980. Yes. But the convictions are overturned, but they're not pardoned yet.
No, that's correct. The appeals court... the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals concluded that the Wilmington 10 were wrongfully convicted. They pointed out specifically the corruption of the prosecutor, the misconduct of the prosecutor in withholding evidence, the collaboration of the judge in keeping that evidence away from the defense, and overturned the convictions, saying that they did not have a fair trial. I just point out something here, that when the convictions were overturned, almost immediately, the what was being sent out was that their convictions were overturned on a technicality. In fact, it was not a technicality at all. It was a sham trial, and there was no evidence linking them to the crimes.
Technically, prosecutorial misconduct is illegal. especially when the judge is involved.
Yes.
A gross technicality. The Bev Perdue actually pardons them in 2012, so that's 32 years after the convictions are overturned. I want to talk to you now, though, kind of fast forward, or talk about the impact of this on black politics, because I think that's an important part of the piece of the story.
Yes. What is interesting to me about this campaign, about the Wilmington 10, was, first of all, the issue that sparked it was something that was occurring all throughout the South. The response of the authorities of trumping up charges was something that was extraordinarily common in the late 1960s and early 1970s. You know, Angela Davis was put on trial. Fred Hampton, the Black Panther leader, was murdered. This is something that happened all over. The other thing that is significant to me is that this was a movement that was led by groups of people who had very radical critiques of American society, American racial order, the American economic order, and they linked the case of the Wilmington 10, this particular instance of injustice, to systemic problems across the board. And it was a movement that brought moderate people into the orbit of the left, and I think that's very important. You don't see people running away from it. You see people gravitating toward the left.
And many of the issues are still with us today.
Yes,
Kenneth Jenkin, thank you so much for writing this book and talking with us today. Kenneth Jenkin, a professor of African American and Diaspora Studies at UNC Chapel Hill, author of the book The Wilmington 10, going to be at Quill Ridge Books in Raleigh on January 21st at 7 o'clock. He has other appearances as well. Check out our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, the music of Professor Toon. Stay tuned.
Yeah. Yeah.